Good evening. I would like to call the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Today is March 22nd, 2023. Let the record reflect that it is 6:04 p.m. Today we have present Speaker Kathy Tilton, Representative Tom McKay, Representative Kevin McCabe, Representative Jamie Allard, Representative Cliff Groh, Representative Andrew Gray, and myself, Chair Carpenter. Thank you all for joining us tonight. We have a couple presentations to get to. I would like to remind committee members and members of the public here in the room to silence your cell phones. Kevin Allen and Zachary Lawhorn will be assisting us in the with the House records and the LIO today. My staff, Kendra Broussard, will be the committee aide. And somebody owes donuts. All right. Let's see the two presentations that we'll have today are from Director of Tax Division Colleen Glover and Deputy Director of the Tax Division Brandon Spanos, if I pronounced that right. All right, sir. Also the Department of Revenue. The first first presentation we'll have is on tax programs, and the second and tax exemptions, and the second will be on revenue options. So if you will, I will invite you forward begin your presentation by putting your name on the record, and let's get busy. Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record, and we have our presentation all queued up and ready to go. Let's get started. Please give us your name and put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Good evening, committee. Thank you for having us here. My name is Colleen Glover. I'm the Tax Division Director.
And I'm Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director for the Tax Division.
So tonight we're here just to talk about, give you kind of a high-level overview of all of the tax programs that we administer on behalf of the state and give you a little bit of information about each one of those programs. We'll also be going over tax exemptions, too, to look at those, and that includes a lot of different tax credits, different, like, motor vehicle exemptions, even, like, the fishing license that you get at a certain age where you can get one to last for a long time. So we'll go over a lot of those different exemptions. So what we're going to be presenting is based on fiscal year 2022 revenues that were collected for all of these programs. A lot of the programs you'll see is we share revenue from a lot of these different tax programs, and we share with fishing taxes get shared with the region where the fish was landed, but we still collect those taxes and we share them. What we report is all revenues collected. Some of these other go into most of the tax revenue is general fund. Some of these go into other restricted funds. There's some of the alcohol tax that goes into some other specific funds, but the numbers we're sharing is all revenue collections. The other one that kind of is a little bit unique is property tax. The state administers property tax, but a large is over almost 80% of that actually goes to the local jurisdictions where it's oil and gas property tax only where that resides. And just the last comment is, over the last couple of years, because of COVID and some of the unique situations and some of the money from the federal government, there was provisions in the ARPA funds that replace lost tax revenues. Those replaced funds are not included in our numbers because they weren't tax revenue we collected. Moving on to slide 4, this is a summary of all of the revenue we collected for fiscal year 2022. You can see we collected $2.7 billion, which was a significant year for us for total tax collections. You'll see they're sorted from largest to smallest in dollar amounts. And you can see by far the largest one is our oil and gas production tax, which was about 67% of total revenues. That typically is the largest, but not always to that magnitude. The other biggest one is our corporate income tax. That line there for the $400 million is both non-petroleum corporate income tax and petroleum income tax, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. The next slide, slide 5, shows these same programs, but by the number of taxpayers, just to give you a magnitude of, I call taxpayer customers, right? That's who we support and work with. They're our primary interface. So you can see by the number of taxpayers, the corporate income tax by far, with about 20,000 taxpayers, is our largest program and 86% of our actual taxpayers. And you'll see the smallest program has 3 taxpayers. So, you know, the message is very broad. Different kind of taxes, different number of taxpayers, and definitely very broad in the amount of revenues brought in. What I find interesting is some of the larger by number of taxpayers, such as Terrible Gaming with over 1,000 taxpayers, it is one of the smallest programs as far as revenues, with maybe 2 to 3 million a year. So it's they're all just very different and interesting.
Representative Gray has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, it's kind of a dumb question, but when I see tobacco taxes and I see there's 50 taxpayers, I think of people paying whenever they buy a pack of cigarettes as paying a tobacco tax, and I would think of that person as a taxpayer. Can you just explain what that 50 means?
Sure, Rep. Gray, through the chair, and we'll get into a lot more detail on each tax program, but the tobacco tax is a wholesale tax. It is not a retail tax, at least the statewide tax. And so one thing to realize is there could be local jurisdictions that have similar taxes, and a lot of those are at the retail level, but the state tax is a wholesale tax.
And I'll just add, Rep. Gray, through the chair, that it's basically whoever files the tax return, that's who we identify as a taxpayer. So even though you're paying the tax when you buy the product, you're not filing a tax return, and therefore, in our eyes, not a taxpayer.
So now we're going to get into all of the specific tax programs, and just to make things maybe a little bit more interesting, we decided to group them in some kind of topics. So the first group is, and you'll see here in order by totals, that the natural resources one is, you know, by far the biggest amount. The $2.3 billion from last year was about 87% of total tax revenues. We also have some business taxes and utilities, sin taxes, which is a standard term for taxes imposed to kind of for behavior that's not seen as, you know, what you might want, which is usually alcohol, tobacco, and gambling. We have quite a few fishing programs, actually, a lot of those, and then we have a lot related to tourism and transportation. So as far as natural resources on slide 8, the oil and gas production tax, which is very complex tax, it's on all oil and gas production within the state. The royalty barrels, so royalty, state royalty barrels and federal royalty barrels, are not taxed. And it's actually different. The North Slope oil and gas is taxed differently than Cook Inlet oil and gas tax. The North Slope is one segment for tax purposes, and Cook Inlet is taxed basically by field. So there's several Cook Inlet tax segments. Basically a 35% net profits tax, and it has a 4% gross minimum tax floor that the tax can't go below, typically. This kind of current regime has been in place since 2013. There has been a few modifications over the last 10 years, primarily related to tax credits. There was some clawback of Cook Inlet tax credits in 2016, and then there was some change to the cashable tax credits in 2017, but kind of the underlying tax regime has been in place for quite a while. There was a unique provision back in 2014 in SB 38 that was intended for major gas sale and a gas line that changed the gas tax to a 13% gross. That law was passed in 2014 with effective date of January 1st, 2022, and that law never changed. So that did go into effect last year. So that was a fairly recent change. Then moving on to the oil and gas property tax, as I stated, it's a statewide tax on oil and gas property, pipelines, transportation systems, and facilities. It's administered by the state of Alaska. The municipal portion is a credit against the state tax. It averages about kind of 80% to the local jurisdiction and the state 20%. If any of the pipeline properties, such as like the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, it goes through unorganized areas, all of that tax comes to the state. The tax rate is 20 mils or 2% of the assessed value, and it's one of our programs that we actually do the assessments. And that tax has basically been unchanged for the most part since 1973. Moving on to slide 9, this is to talk about the oil and gas corporate tax, income tax. You can see the tax brackets. One thing to note, the tax brackets are the same whether it's a petroleum company or a non-petroleum company. There is a little bit of difference between the two, and that's kind of how their income is allocated. But otherwise, the tax is basically the same between the petroleum and the non-petroleum. The oil and gas is kind of, that's on a worldwide basis instead of a water's edge for the non-petroleum that you'll hear about soon. And the mining income, it's called mining license tax. It's basically similar. It's a net income tax. It's on any net income and royalties over 40,000. There's a lot of small miners that fall below that threshold. You can see the tax was enacted quite a bit ago, and the tax program has really been unchanged since 1955. And it's also excluded for the first 3.5 years of when the mining activity starts. So these graphs you'll see, it's to show kind of the historical over the last 20 years, how the those different tax programs for the revenues. So you can see the bright blue line is the oil and gas production tax. So you can see like how varied it is from year to year, with a peak of nearly $7 billion in the late 2000s and in the mid-2010s where it really kind of fell. And luckily, like in fiscal year 2022, there was a significant increase, but it is by far the most volatile revenue source that we have in the tax division. The gray line is the oil and gas corporate income tax. It is still somewhat volatile because it's, you know, a lot of the earnings is based on oil prices, but not as much as production tax. You can see the property tax is really pretty stable and is usually about $120 million a year. And the mining license tax is pretty stable and around, I think, about $40 million per year.
All right, I'm going to talk about the next sections. This again, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director for the Tax Division, for the record. And I'm going to go over the non-oil and gas corporate income tax and some other of the a few other taxes before I hand it back to Colleen. So the corporate income tax, there really is just one tax. It's found in 4319, which is the Multi-State Tax Compact, and 4320, which is Alaska's adjustments to the Multi-State Tax Compact. And that tax compact was written by several, I think it was 19 states originally that adopted it. It basically was striving to tax the income of a corporation, to not double tax it, not tax the same income multiple times in both various states. And so we came up with, or the compact came up with what's called UDIPA, which is the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act. It basically says there's a pie and every state can get a slice of the pie, and there should only be one whole pie. You can't have a pie and a half, right? Which is what was happening prior to UDIPA, is the totality of the states were taxing more than 100% of the income of a corporation, multi-state corporation. So UDIPTA said, okay, there's a pie, every state gets a slice. How do you determine the slice? And they determine the slice by saying, we're going to use three factors, property, payroll, and sales. You take the property, payroll, and sales in the state over the property, payrolls, and the sales everywhere. And when we say everywhere, it's called water's edge. So back before Hawaii became a state, the country went to the water's edge. And so they said that's U.S. income. And so everyone gets a slice of that pie. Brackets are the same because the tax is ultimately the same. The difference between the corporate income tax as applied to non-oil and gas companies and applied to oil and gas companies is that the oil and gas companies have a separate apportionment factor rather than property payroll sales. It's property payroll sales extraction. So they replaced the payroll with extraction. And the tax has been around for a long time. As you can see, it was first enacted in 1949. And those are the current brackets. The next tax type is really, we have a few what we would call pass-through taxes. We don't really administer the tax so much as we collect the revenue and share it. The RCA tax is the most pass-through because we don't even have a tax return. RCA gets the return from the filers, and we just collect the revenue and then share that to the RCA. The customer ultimately is the one paying the tax to the utility. The utility then pays the tax, files with the RCA and pays us, and then we share that with the RCA. I do have on here, we did list the number of taxpayers earlier. Again, for the corporate income tax, that's 20,000, just over 20,152. And then for the RCA, I don't have a number because they don't file tax returns with us. And 100% of that revenue, like I mentioned, goes through. The electronic cooperative tax is a pretty small tax. So there's 17 taxpayers in this pool. And Alaska levies this tax on kilowatt hours furnished by qualified electronic cooperatives. The taxes on those kilowatt hours and the applicable rate is based on the number of years the electronic cooperative has furnished electricity and power to their customers. Telephone cooperative is similar. There are 7 taxpayers here that file returns with us and pay the tax. The tax is based on gross revenue, and the applicable rate is based on the number of years the telephone cooperative has furnished the telephone services to their customers. The revenue is shared 100% with municipalities, and that's where that electricity is generated. And if there is no municipality, it goes into the general fund. And backing up to the electronic cooperative, those revenues are also shared 100% with the municipalities where the cooperative generates the revenue. And then that, if it's outside of a municipality, it's 100% to the general fund. And I'll pass it back to, and then here's the slide showing the revenues over the years. I'll pass it back to Colleen.
Okay. For the record, Colleen Glover, Tax Division Director. So here's the bucket that we've called sin taxes. As we talked about, the tobacco is at the wholesale level, as distributor wholesalers, and some retailers. You can see the tax rate. It's about $2 per pack and 75% of other tobacco products. It has increased quite a bit. There has been, a lot of statutory changes along the years to increase the tax rates, primarily on the cigarettes. The alcoholic beverage use tax is also a wholesale tax paid by distributors and wholesalers. It's based on the type of alcohol. And per gallon, you can see there's quite a few different rates here, and there is kind of the reduced rate for small breweries. One thing to note is last year, Senate Bill number 9 created a new alcohol tax, and it's a direct seller tax, and that has an effective date of January 1st, 2024. So we have not collected anything yet, nor have we implemented the program, but that will be a focus of this year to do that. The other one, the marijuana tax, is also paid at the wholesale level. It's tax on the marijuana cultivators. It's a per ounce tax. This one was created with a ballot measure, and there are a few different variations of parts of the plants with some different rates that you'll see on the different tax rates.
Question for you on the yet to be implemented Senate Bill 9 text, new Senate Bill 9. Do you have a projection of what you would anticipate that that's going to levy? It probably was discussed when we passed the bill, and I just don't remember.
Chair Commodore, great question. I don't recall, but we can get back to you. I'm sure we did a fiscal note last year.
Yeah, thank you. Please continue.
The last two in this group are related to gambling and gaming. So we do have a large passenger vessel gambling tax, which is assessed on the cruise ships that come to the state. That tax is by the vessel owner, and it's 33% of their adjusted gross income from gambling activities in a certain, within the state water. So it's just a certain part of the voyage where the gambling occurs that the state gets a portion of that. And that one too is also enacted by a ballot measure. The last here is our charitable gaming program. This one is a little bit different than a lot of our tax programs, and where we are really kind of the regulator and permittee for charitable gaming. There's a lot of entities involved. We have over 1,000 permittees that range, you know, like Lions Club, but, you know, Boys and Girls Club, all kinds of different. It could be a political organization, fraternal, police officer unions, all pretty wide variety. There are some small fees that they pay. The tax component is really just for the pool towns. It's the only component that has a tax. There's a 3% tax on pool towns to the state. It's been a pretty stable revenue source, but one thing, a recent change was to expand the gaming for raffles and a few special games to do online. I think there was some temporary legislation during kind of the primary COVID time that allowed for that, and that was kind of made permanent last year in Senate Bill 206. And you'll see on the next slide where the revenues actually increased a little bit last year, so it's hard to tell if it really is due to kind of maybe expanded outreach for those groups, but we think it's been a positive for a lot of the charitable organizations.
I'd like the record to reflect that we were joined by Senator Myers some time ago. I'm not sure exactly what time you strolled in. Thank you for joining us, sir.
So on slide 16 is the graphical representation of the last 20 years of revenues for these programs. You can see by far the tobacco tax has been the largest in this bucket, and it is interesting to see that that really dropped off in the last year. It had been pretty steady, but it was a pretty significant drop last year. Not sure why that did. We would have maybe expected it to maybe increase during lockdowns and such, but it decreased revenues.
Perhaps it was masks. please continue. Yeah.
The largest is the alcohol beverages tax. That has been holding pretty steady in the $40 million range. The gray line, you can see where that started in fiscal year 2017, was the first actual revenues from marijuana tax, where that was on a very steep increase in the early years. And it had been increasing until just recently, and it's kind of dropped from the high in 2021 of $30 million, and it dropped off to about $28 million for fiscal year 2022. The other, you can see the gaming related ones are pretty small dollars. The vessel gambling tax on the yellow line, it dropped off completely in fiscal year 2021 due to the closure of the cruise industry. There was a modest recovery in fiscal year 2022, but we expect that will rebound to the historical average around $8 million a year. And like I said, the gaming has been pretty consistent of just under $3 million a year.
On the wrong thing. Okay, so we're going to move on to the fish taxes. And the way this presentation works is the taxes that I'm least familiar with are the ones I'm presenting on. I apologize for that. The fisheries business tax is basically a tax on processed fish. So if it's processed in Alaska, this tax applies, and it's 5% for a floating processor, 4.5% for salmon cannery, and 3% for shore-based processing. If it's a developing fishery, then it's less. There's a floating, the rate's smaller. It's a 3% for floating processors and 1% for shore-based processors. The number of taxpayers, I believe, is 444 in 2022. It just happened to be all fours. And the resource landing tax is really a similar tax. It's trying to capture what you could maybe call a loophole in the original fisheries business tax. So the fisheries business tax applies to fish processed in Alaska or unprocessed fish landed outside of Alaska. So the loophole is unprocessed fish landed in Alaska and then exported out of Alaska. That was not taxed, so the fisheries resource landing tax captures that. And again, it's just for fish landed here. It's usually flash frozen and then shipped out. And for that, there are far fewer taxpayers. There's 36 taxpayers. And then there are several much smaller fish tax programs. Most of these are pass-through programs. Some of them are what we call assessments, which is an association has a tax on a certain area, and we collect tax on fish caught in that area and then share it back to the association. So the seafood marketing tax is a tax assessed on the seafood processed for fish landed in Alaska. The state also levies the assessment on unprocessed fisheries products exported from Alaska. And we collect the assessment from seafood processors, fishermen who export the fishery resource out of the state. There were 185 taxpayers in that program. The seafood enhancement tax is an elective tax. And basically there's this was the one I was talking about earlier. It's a pass-through, so those associations actually elect their own tax. The rates are all set through that process. They were all 3% up through 2013. And the number of taxpayers in that program were 242. Then there's the seafood development tax, which has had there's 50 taxpayers, and there was $3.1 million collected from that tax in fiscal year 22. It is a tax, again, an elective tax levied on certain fishery resources using specific gear types sold or exported from designated seafood development regions. And I'm sorry to bore you with such a specific explanation, but as I mentioned, not an expert in this tax program. The last two fish programs are dive fishery management assessment. And that is an assessment in the elective assessment on the value of fisheries resources taken using dive gear. So as long as you're using that dive gear, this rate applies, or this tax applies. There were 21 taxpayers in fiscal year 2022, and that rate, that's pretty standard. So in 2019, there were 20. In 2022, there were 21. It's a fairly small assessment. There was $550,000 collected in 2022. And then lastly, the common fishery assessment is a cost recovery fishery assessment that the Alaska legislature authorized in 2006. It allows hatcheries to establish a common property fishery and recoup costs through an assessment of the fishery resource taken in that harvest area. And you can see here the fisheries business tax is by and large the largest tax. Program. Our fish group is a very small group. They're experts in all these programs and work with all of the fishermen. Taxpayers. And the motor fuel tax program. Sorry, let me get into my other slides here. Has 110 taxpayers. It's levied on motor fuel tax. It's a true excise tax. So earlier there was a question about who's the taxpayer. We all pay tax when we go to the pump, but you don't see it on your receipt. That it would be a sales tax if you saw it on your receipt and you're actually paying the tax. It's an excise tax when it's up higher. So this tax is paid by the wholesaler. The fuel comes into the state. The wholesaler or distributor is the one that pays the tax. And it's a relatively small tax. In fact, it's the smallest in the nation. You can see here the rates are on this slide. So it's 8 cents for the highway, 5 cents for marine. There's avgas, jet fuel, and then there's a surcharge. The surcharge was added most recently, I think it's there on the slide, 2015, by the legislature, and that was for cleanup costs associated with fuel spills. This is one I'm familiar with. I could talk more, but I will, unless there's any questions, I'll move on to the next. Commercial passenger vessel tax, or otherwise known as the CPV tax. This is the head tax on passengers that come up on the commercial vessels. It was originally a 30, or rather a $46 tax, I believe. And it's been reduced down to $34.50. It's shared with the $5 per head, per person, per port for the first 7 ports of call, which is an interesting calculation because when there are 7 ports of call, we actually share more than we receive in revenue. There are most of the vessels don't visit 7 ports, and therefore we net positive, but it is kind of an interesting share. Again, that's $5 per person per port. There are 2 grandfathered programs. That's Ketchikan and Juneau. They both had their own assessments prior to the passage of this assessment, and therefore they are reduced. The rate is reduced off. The passenger still pays the $34.50, but Ketchikan and Juneau get that their share first. And I believe we also share that $5 in those cases. This is because of constitutional issues, the money has to be paid, or rather the tax collected has to be paid for infrastructure around the ports, basically that benefit both the vessel and the passengers. So there was a time where, you know, the road from the port to the museum was thought to be a benefit, but that didn't benefit the vessel directly. So the vehicle rental tax, there are 100, I didn't tell you the number of taxpayers in commercial in the CPV tax or the commercial passenger vessel tax. That one varies. It's 8 to 17, depending on which year you're looking at. 17 is about the highest we've had in the last several years. The vehicle rental tax has 157 taxpayers. This tax is 10% on the total fees collected for a lease, or it's 3% for the total fees collected on a vehicle if it's a recreational vehicle. And in looking at some of the legislative history, it looks like the reason for that was the cost to rent a recreational vehicle was much more expensive, and the 3% basically netted the same revenue to the state as the 10% tax on a car or a normal rented vehicle. The taxpayer is the person who owns or provided the leased product rental vehicle to the individual. The state sees that as if you are the owner of the vehicle or the renter of the vehicle, that's the taxpayer. And next we have tire fees. So tire fees are paid by the dealer. So mostly that's a tire dealer. It could be a dealership, so a car dealer, if they were also to sell tires. So when I bought a car a few years ago, it came with studded tires that were separate from the tires that the manufacturer put on. I would pay the tax, again, as an excise tax. The dealer's ultimately the one filing the return thing. There's 72 of those. The tax last year, in fiscal year 2022, was $1.6 million. The tax rate is $2.50 for regular tires and $5 for what's considered a heavy stud or like metal studs in your tires. And that's so it's 1.1 gram is considered a heavy stud.
Please let the record reflect that 6:39, Representative Stapp and Representative Sumner joined us. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us. Please continue.
And then there are exceptions, as there are with most taxes, for tires sold to the federal government, the state government, local governments, were not intended for use on the public road. So if you buy them for a ATV and you're going to drive off-road, then you wouldn't pay the tax. Here we have, like the other slides, the revenue over the years. You can see quite a bit of fluctuation, and it's interesting that in 2009 it looks like there's some connection there. There is not. The orange line is the commercial passenger vessel line. As I mentioned, when that was first enacted in 2007, it had almost 25% higher tax. So it was a I've written that down. I've forgotten now. It is was a $46 tax originally per head, and now it's $34.50. And when it went down to $34.50, they also passed a statute that said so originally it was if your vessel total travel time was 72 hours or more, the tax applied to you. When they reduced the rate, when the legislature reduced the rate, they also said it's 72 hours in Alaska. So that exempted certain vessels that were paying the tax previously because their total trip was over 72 hours, but maybe they were only a day or two in Alaska. And that's why we see such a drop there. And then coincidentally, in the same period of time, the legislature suspended the motor fuel tax. That was from September 1st, 2008 through August 31st, 2009. And that's why we see the motor fuel tax go down that same period.
I think we had large revenue flowing into the state at that point in time, didn't we?
Right. Rather than give a payment for fuel, we would just cancel the tax for a while or suspended it.
Thank you. Please continue.
That was our last tax program slide. These are the. This slide basically shows new tax programs over the last several years. So alcohol tax, I believe that was SB9. So I recently came back to the tax division after being gone for a few years. I followed that bill in previous sessions, and so no, it was in it. But it looks like it's 2024 when that's going to become effective. The motor fuel tax or that surcharge I talked about. Added was in 2015. That was the 0.95 cent tax. The marijuana tax, which was in 2014. When I say that, I have a little bit of a trauma response because I had to set up that cash room for the marijuana tax, and that was a heavy lift with very little revenue at the time. Oil prices tanked and left us with little money to set that up. Large passion.
I think that alcohol bill took 10 years to rewrite, so that sets the stage here for how long. Anyway, please continue.
And then we have commercial passenger vessel tax. And back to the alcohol, I believe that, if I'm remembering right, that one really is just trying to capture sales that are purchased and shipped to the state where we don't have a wholesaler in the state to pay the tax. So it's basically direct shipments. Commercial passenger vessel tax was first enacted in 2006, and you can read the others. I'm not going to read each for you there. And there is the bullet. It says it here in the bullet, but I'll read it. Many of these do have provisions where they're designated, so not all of this goes into the general fund. It's a pass-through, or there's a certain designation where it's applied, especially, as I mentioned, those fisheries taxes.
So the next section, for the record, is Colin Glover. We're going to talk about some different tax exemptions that exist today. So there's a few documents that you may or may not be familiar with. They're what is called an indirect expenditure. Indirect expenditure is any foregone revenue to the state. Like it could be in the form of a tax credit, an exemption, a discount, deduction, or any kind of statutory provision that kind of reduces some payment to the state. And there's a couple of different good documents. There is a report that our group does every 2 years that it lists every indirect expenditure for the state, kind of gives historical information about it and the amount of kind of foregone revenue from each of those and the number of beneficiaries of those indirect expenditures. And then also Legislative Finance does a similar report using our data, but they go into a deep dive by department every 2 years, and they'll actually more analyze those indirect expenditures and if they met the intended reason for implementing those. So our most recent report was from 2017 to 2021 fiscal year data. It came out mid last year, and we're going to just talk about kind of the top ones, because there are hundreds of them. So on slide 27 is a summary of the value of the indirect expenditures by department and then the number. So you can see the revenue impact in fiscal year 2021 was about $1 billion, and there was 263 specific indirect expenditure items. We get the privilege of the Department of Revenue having the bulk of those, and so 80% of the value of that $1 billion were items within the Department of Revenue and tax. So what we'll have here are the top 10 by value from fiscal year 2021. The top three here are all from the oil and gas production tax. The first item, the largest item, is the per taxable barrel credit for non-gross value reduction eligible production. That is also, sometimes we refer to it as legacy production, but that is the bulk, or 80% of our production qualifies for this. It's a credit per barrel, per taxable barrel, that ranges from $8 to zero. And the value at $8 is based on when the value of the oil is $80 or less. As oil prices rise, if the value goes up to $90, then the tax credit reduces to $7 per barrel, excuse me. So it kind of has a sliding scale impact. It really is a component to the overall tax system. It's a net profits tax, and the per barrel credits were built in to kind of have some progressivity. So it's not always a 30% tax rate. You can see the number of beneficiaries has been between 4 and 8 companies, so a pretty limited number of taxpayers impacted by this one. The next line is, because a lot of the tax credits we've had for oil and gas production have been phased out. I mentioned that earlier. There's been quite a few legislative changes over the past few years, really, to phase out a lot of the credits. So as they phase out, there's less beneficiaries, and due to our kind of confidentiality statutes for reporting, we combine those in here so we could still provide some level information. Those amounted to $48 million. So by far, like, the value is a lot less than the per barrel tax credits. And like I said, these have all either been expired or in the process of expiring for this bucket of all these credits. The next item is what is the gross value reduction, which was an incentive put in for new production, and it reduces the kind of tax basis for those barrels. And it's a kind of a limited scope. You get it for the first 7 years, or that's reduced to 3 years if oil prices are $70 or more, but it is kind of an incentive to give a tax break in the early years for new oil, new fields, new participating areas. That too has kind of a limited number of beneficiaries, and the impact from fiscal year 21 was $23 million. The next seven are all motor fuel tax. Like, you'll see there are a lot of different exemptions, and these are all from the base rate of the 8 cents per gallon. There's lots of either exemptions or reduced rates for various reasons, and all of these add up to about $50 million. And we don't have the information about the number of beneficiaries.
I will note, if I can butt in, some of these are required by federal law. They tried to change this during that when the surcharge came to pass, and it was like they didn't want to exempt anything for the surcharge. Some of it, like the fuel used on flights to foreign countries, the Foreign Commerce Clause dictates that you can't tax that. So.
And lastly, just some information where a lot of this information already resides. Everything in our report or that we talked about today is information in our annual report. It has amazing amount of information. It has a legislative history of every tax program we administer by year, the bill, all the changes, all the tax rates. There's a wealth of information that's all out on our website. As I talked about, the indirect expenditure is available on our website, and then also our forecast. And now we have the spring forecast that is on our website now. So there's a wealth of information about these tax programs available. We have lots of data and reporting for each of these tax programs, and we're always more than happy to provide more detailed information on any programs.
I hesitate to ask the question, but now that the Willow Project has been approved, there's been some talk about what it's going to cost the state. Which exemption or category would that fall into that we're looking at? Is that the oil tax or oil and gas production tax credit?
Chair Carpenter, the Willow Project isn't an exemption by itself, but there's a lot of different pieces from the oil and gas production tax that impacts it. I mean, that project will impact corporate income tax as well as the production tax, but the spending, it will qualify for that gross value reduction where there is kind of a discount on the tax base for that is a new field. It will qualify for that component.
Okay, thank you.
And that was all we had on this presentation.
I'm not seeing any hands raised. Maybe?
I'm trying. Go ahead.
You have at least one. Representative Gray? Okay.
Although a publication will say, well, he goes back so many slides. If you go to slide 23, when I look at that slide and I see that motor fuel tax and that huge dip, and I know that you guys said that at that time we had, a ton of money coming in, so we won't tax anymore. So I just want to say to future legislators, don't stop taxing. Save that money. You're going to need it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Okay, no additional questions. Let's transition to the next presentation.
Stay awake.
Yeah.
Got it?
Breezy.
Meat locker style.
Okay.
We're ready.
Okay. Thanks again for having us here. Moving on to the next topic, and for the record, Colleen Glover, Tax Division Director. We're going to talk about other revenue options, not necessarily what we have in place now. Some of the ideas are changes from what we have, but most of these are focused on new revenue options. One thing to note, these are options and information the committee asked us to come present about. This is not any viewpoint from the administration, but just potential revenue options. A lot of these items are things that have been looked at by the department and the division for years. We're always analyzing just so we are prepared when we get asked for questions like this. So we do have some tools to help. Some more sophisticated than others, but these are things that we look at just so we are prepared to help out as needed. So the first topic, and we were asked to present on broad-based taxes. So here one option is a sales tax. So, a sales tax by definition is a broad-based tax that's levied typically on goods and services. And most states do have a statewide sales tax. Last we checked, 45 states do. Most states typically collect that on behalf of local jurisdictions as well and then disperse them. Alaska is a little bit unique where there's a local sales tax, but not a statewide sales tax, and each local jurisdiction does their own collections and management of the sales tax. One other thing, and like sometimes it's, we use the term use tax. So a sales and use tax is usually when you buy something in another state for use in your state. That typically isn't, you know, an issue between like Washington and Oregon where people go somewhere else. So it could include that. So we, a lot of times the term is the sales and use tax. So this option we picked South Dakota, it is a very broad tax, sales tax compared to other states. And we also had kind of looked at South Dakota, trying to look at other states that are kind of similar population, similar industries to kind of gauge, you know, if you compare it to South Dakota, what they collect, what could that equate to Alaska? But it is a very broad tax, and it does not only tax goods, the purchase of a good, but it also taxes services. And it also taxes business-to-business transactions as well. So there could be things that get taxed from one to the next step. South Dakota currently has a 4.5% sales tax. This option, just for consistency, we picked a 4% tax rate to use. And our estimation of a 4% sales tax, similar to what South Dakota does, could generate $1.8 billion per year. That would be on a full year impact. We had looked into sales tax implementation a couple of years back during special session, and at that time we had analyzed positions on the impact on the division. It's a big tax, and it would be a big lift, and we estimated it takes 74 people to do that, which our division is 96 people, so it would be a pretty big change to us. But one thing to note too is if the information we presented similar information in the past, these numbers are significantly different. We have for the last year reached out to, in anticipation of being able to provide good modeling information, we did engage with a third-party consultant to validate our models, one being the sales tax model. It has been a great effort, and they actually provided us with insights and realized that, you know, our models weren't as accurate as we would like them to be, and so these updated numbers are based on results from the consultant.
We have a question from Representative McCabe.
Thank you. Through the chair. First full year impact, what does that mean? So I think in the fiscal policy working group, it was 2 years, I think, before we would see the revenue, something like that, 18 months to 2 years. So what does the first full year impact mean?
So Rep. McCabe, through the chair, that would be when there is a full year of actual collections. We expect if a broad-based tax was passed, it would take us a year to implement. So it would be like the year after.
Thank you.
And Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director, I'll add that often an effective date is mid-fiscal year. And so we would look at the full fiscal year.
Thank you.
One thing to note too on our taxes that from a tax division perspective, most tax years are calendar years. So then having to convert into fiscal year sometimes gets challenging as they don't necessarily line up with our tax returns. But yeah, it would be a full fiscal year of actual collections.
And if I could butt in again, Brandon Spanos, on a sales tax, it really doesn't, it's a monthly tax. So you pay every month. So really what I said about the fiscal year would apply to an income tax, but not a sales tax.
So moving on to slide 4, similar, but we base this on Wyoming sales tax. So Wyoming is fairly similar to South Dakota and Alaska in size and population. The Wyoming sales tax is actually 4%, but it's still broad, but not as broad as South Dakota is. And one area that they differ is really on the business-to-business transactions, but they still are broad. And it would also, one thing to note is that this is just looking at the revenue impact of the sales tax itself. It doesn't consider that what the impact might be if you're taxing business transactions or a Wyoming sales tax that taxes mineral services. So if those are taxed, it could have impact on other taxes. It could have impact on our corporate income tax, the oil and gas production tax, if you're taxing those transactions. So this is kind of looking at the sales tax by itself. One thing to note, the implementation and the staffing is similar, but this one is significantly different in revenue. You can see here that a full year of collections is about $600 million, so about a third of the South Dakota tax.
Representative Gray for a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, I noticed on the South Dakota one, it said that there were few exemptions, and so you didn't mention groceries. So South Dakota, does their sales tax go on all food? There's no exemptions for any groceries whatsoever?
Rep. Gray, I believe so, but I can confirm that with you. Yeah.
Another question from Representative Groh.
Thank you, Chair Crumker. Ms. Glover, I note there's roughly a $1.2 billion difference between the South Dakota and Wyoming sales tax scenarios. And following up on what Representative Gray's question, you mentioned groceries. Is it your understanding that groceries are the bulk of that $1.2 billion difference?
A Representative Grove through the chair. It's not just the groceries. A lot of it is all the business-to-business transactions, where South Dakota basically has limited exemptions and taxes those transactions that Wyoming doesn't.
I would be interested to follow up, Mr.
Representative Grove.
I would be interested in getting a breakdown of that. That would be a useful thing, I think, for the committee to understand in terms of the very substantial, like I said, approximately $1.2 billion difference.
Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director, through the chair, Representative Groh, a lot of that is business inputs, but we can provide more information and detail on the model.
Thank you. Thank you. Please continue.
And then just to give a little context, there is a very wide range of the base or the tax base on what for a sales tax. And so this is kind of a narrower base on what is taxed. And this option here excludes all services, and it's really just targeting typical brick and mortar store purchases and online sales. So having a similar 4% sales tax here results in about $350 million. So, quite a bit significantly smaller than the South Dakota kind of model, and about 60% of the Wyoming model. But this is really limited to the purchase of goods and not the services and the business-to-business transactions.
All right. Again, for the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director of the Tax Division, and I'm going to go into the income taxes. Not that I want to be the guy talking about income taxes, but here I am. And again, back to the disclaimer, we were requested to come talk about broad-based taxes. There is no broader-based tax than an income tax on individuals. I believe when I last looked, the population of Alaska was somewhere around 750,000. So obviously a lot of children wouldn't have jobs and wouldn't be paying taxes, and some are married filing joint, but the number is still quite large. So the tax on an individual, we looked at different options, and we'll go through each of them. The first option we looked at was 1% of a tax on a federal adjusted gross income. So that's commonly referred to as AGI. So basically, the feds have already helped us to get to a number that's basically taxable, and then the state could apply a rate. We would apply 1% in this scenario, and federal gross income is paid usually out through withholding from your employer. So the state would set up a program that would make that work. And then that would also include what we commonly refer to as pass-through entities. So this corporate income tax that we went over in our last presentation applies to C corporations and not to S corporations, LLCs, sole proprietorships, any other entity that would quote unquote pass through from the business to your individual income tax return. So an individual income tax return, again, most states have, in fact, Alaska is the only state that doesn't have one of the three major tax types that all the other states rely on, which are property, sales, or individual income tax. So we are fairly unique. I go to some multi-state conventions. I kind of take some pride in the fact that, you know, we are quite unique in a lot of ways, but taxing as well. With the budget problems the way we have, I understand why we're talking about this. But the reason that that the C corp taxes the way that it is in most other states is because they also have an individual income tax, and so there is no need to have a pass through tax. Although some states like California do have a fee on LLCs, and which kind of looks like a tax as well. So it's almost a tax on multiple layers. So this particular scenario would bring in $337 million, which you can see would be 11% of what was collected in FY22. The costs to implement a tax, it would require fewer individuals because we would be working directly with public rather than with retailers. And in a sales tax scenario, there are a lot of moving when working with businesses. There's just a lot more customer service that happens than with a once a year filed tax return, and so there's fewer individuals required. It's $8.8 million in annual administration costs, and then a setup fee for our online system that where a taxpayer would go and file, which we are going to a new. System. We've been on a system for several years that the legislature gave us an appropriation for, which we really, really appreciated. It's a great system, and we're moving to a newer version of that, which allows taxpayers to file a return on their phone. Which, because we don't have a broad-based tax, that means that, you know, the miners and the fishermen and those that do file can do it. But with a broader base like this, it would affect a lot of people, where it would be quite simple. Moving on to the next scenario, 1% of federal income.
Representative Groh.
I did want to ask a few questions about this slide. And thank you, Mr. Chair. You said you've worked with other states and are aware, you know, what other states are taxing. Isn't it true that most other states have both a personal income tax and a statewide sales tax? It's the general application.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, yes.
Isn't it true that about two-thirds of the states have both a general statewide sales tax and a personal income tax?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I'm not aware of the exact. Now, I know that we're the only state that doesn't have one of the three major taxes. As far as what's the percentage of just those two, I do not know. I'd have to look.
Chair, if I could follow up.
Representative Groh.
You mentioned also that in terms of the income or the revenues that can be made from an income tax. And first of all, I wanted to thank and compliment the chair. Having sat through a number of presentations, both as a citizen and as a legislator, the income, the personal income tax does not always appear in the administration's presentations. Like I said, I appreciate this. Would some of the taxes be paid on an income tax? Would some of the revenues be collected from people who are not residents of Alaska, who made money in Alaska? Either would some of the revenues from a personal income tax in Alaska be collected from non-residents of Alaska?
So through the chair, Representative Groh, certainly the state has the authority to collect that. I think the answer for most states is yes. You could, of course, exempt it. But if income is earned in a state, the state has the right to tax that income.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Groh.
Just for the record, Colleen Glover, just that question, our modeling, these numbers do assume like a 5% non-resident rate in our modeling. So we are assuming there would be some portion of a personal income tax from non-residents.
Mr. Chair, to follow up, I've heard higher numbers than that in terms of the actual amounts of income made by non-residents, in terms of workers on Alaska's North Slope, frequently been discussed over the years in Alaska, people who engage and work in the commercial fish industry, as well as a number of specialty physicians, the surgeons, and Mr. Representative Kay's favorite category, dentists, who are non-residents. Who work in Alaska and make significant incomes. So,
well, it's important for us to get the numbers right. So if you've got data to support a larger number than that, we can compare them.
I heard it was an assumption. Of 5%. In the past, over the years, heard higher investments for that.
All right.
So continuing, Brandon Spanos, our models do use federal information, federal data that's available. It's that information's published by the IRS, and it includes residents of Alaska. So that's why we have to make some assumptions to get to the other numbers. If we were a state that that had a tax, it's super simple. Employers file the 1099s with the state or the W-2s with the state, and then we just check them. And so we would know all the non-resident income to the exact dollar if we had a tax. We don't, so we have to make assumptions for these models. So the next model or scenario that we're looking at is a 1% of federal income tax liability. And so basically this one, because it's the tax is already computed by the federal government, it's basically just saying using those rates, we're just applying another rate on top of it. So 1% of that tax. There have been bills in the past that actually proposed this. There are some complications. The scenario is easy to show and the model is easy to do, but the actual tax to have a state tax return that would do this, it's complicated because there are certain income items that a state can't tax. For example, income from a state bond, or rather a federal bond, the states cannot tax those. And so you would have to back that out, but because it's wrapped up in the tax computation and those earlier brackets, you have to back that out from AGI or somewhere before that. So it gets rather complicated when you're saying, well, you know, I've heard in the past, why don't we just have a tax return on a postage sized thing that says federal tax liability, 1%, and then you file it. Because there are certain things that the state would probably want to exempt or maybe add. And you can't do that after the tax liability is already computed very easily. So, but the computation is simple enough. The first full year would be $264 million. The costs would be the same because ultimately we're dealing with the same taxpayer base. So no matter where you move those levers to, the cost to implement and administer would be the same.
And for the record, Colleen Glover, just one thing to add in general to personal income tax, it is one area where we do have a very good model. As Mr. Spanos had mentioned, we do get information from the IRS, and so we do have good foundational information to use. So we do have a model that it's sophisticated, that we have shared in the past with the legislature to look at stuff, and you can model different tax rate for different income tax brackets or a flat rate or have tax cap or all kinds of fun stuff. So that is one area where we do have a model that can be shared.
A question concerning the model that you're using and maybe a static versus dynamic assessment on what happens to behavior once the tax is implemented. Does your model take that into account, or is this just a static assessment?
Yeah, Chair Carpenter, it is static. It just looks at, that makes it a lot more complicated to try to model behavior, and we typically don't in most of our modeling.
Just making sure. Thank you.
Right. If I were looking at my notes, again, this is Brandon Spanos, I would have read that already, that, you know, that there's economic costs to taxes that, of course, would change behavior. So, for instance, if we were taxing out-of-state income, maybe not as many people would want to work here. Or if you're taxing resident income, maybe certain people would say, well, I don't want to live here anymore. Right. Especially if you're a very high-income earner, maybe you would find a state that doesn't tax your income.
Right. And not to pick on the income tax per se, same thought process would apply to any broad-based tax or sales tax, for example. Representative McKay, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just was, and I don't know if it's a good time to ask, but or maybe we can come back to it later, but, you know, my family, to buy everything off Amazon, it seems like. The UPS, FedEx drivers are at our house, like, every day. So, you know, if we imposed a sales tax like South Dakota, would those purchases get taxed? Or how does that work? I guess I'm just curious. Because everybody's buying everything online now, it seems like, or a lot of people are.
So through the chair, Representative McKay, that's a great question. The states that have had a sales tax for many, many years dealt with this for a long time. So traditionally, only brick-and-mortar transactions were taxed, and then there was a challenge. If you Google Wayfair, you'll find that there was a big case on that. And then the Congress, if you Google Amazon tax, Congress, that's the term they commonly used. The Wayfair decision, basically, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that states can tax transactions from non-residents. So basically, in the past, the nexus, taxing nexus was you had to have, you had to be in the state. There had to be physical presence in the state. Now there's something that basically, if you're taking advantage of the market, that's the taxing nexus. So if I'm advertising in your state or I'm shipping things into your state and trying to go after your residents, we can tax that. So this model, the sales tax models did include that those online transactions.
Yeah, just follow up.
Representative McKay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just find it quite remarkable that the South Dakota sales tax, $1.8 billion, and the income taxes are far less. I thought they would be closer together, but quite a bit more on the South Dakota sales tax model.
And I'll just note on that that it's a 1% income tax and a 4% sales tax on business inputs, which South Dakota, to my knowledge, is the only one that does that. So they have the broadest base, and all the other states, they tax their sales taxes are much narrower, or not narrow is maybe the wrong word, because the taxpayer base is the same, but they have they don't include as many inputs as on what's taxable.
Do you happen to know what an average income tax rate for the states who have income taxes, what that rate might be, just for scale here?
Yeah, we'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay, thanks.
I knew at one time, but it's gone. Okay.
Representative Allard. Representative Allard.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Through the chair, we have a large amount of retired military. It's a big incentive for retired military to live in Alaska because we don't get taxed on our federal retirement. I'm throwing myself in there. So have you guys taken into consideration the impact if we were to lose? I mean, we don't tax them now, but to lose that vast majority, if first they said, okay, they're taxing my retirement, now I'm toast, I can't stay. Have we considered what that could do, or would there be some sort of thought of not income tax on the military retirement, federal retirement?
So through the chair, Representative Allard, as we mentioned earlier, the model doesn't account for those things, and we're trying to take a very unbiased approach, and so the model is just we're looking at the broadest options. Certainly, any legislation could exempt federal retirees or Social Security. That's why I said earlier, 1% of federal tax liability is complicated, not only because some of it's not taxable, but because states want to have the ability to choose rates and what's exempt, what's taxable, what's not.
Representative Allard.
Thank you. Follow up through the chair. So could we get something from you guys that might say, okay, if we lost 10% of the military population, because they live here, they spend money here, we buy houses here, we do everything, right? What would that impact have? I mean, we do have to get the numbers to find out how many retirees are actually up here in the state of Alaska. I could probably dig that out for you or something, but I think it's a reasonable, I've heard military say as soon as this, if the state of Alaska decided to tax my income, my federal retirement income, I'm out. I'm going to Tennessee. I'm going to other states that don't. Can you find out possibly?
So through the chair, Representative Allard, that's certainly something we can.
Something that, because we're huge in military. This could impact us and my district especially. Okay, thank you.
Representative McKay.
If I could, through the chair, if I could respond, I think you could write the income tax law to exempt the retired military.
I think so.
Unless it's unconstitutional. I don't know.
Through the chair, Representative McKay, certainly the state has the ability to not tax certain items of income. You have to look at what's fair rather than in that context. What's constitutional? A state has the constitutional ability or rather authority to tax all income earned in its borders, and retirement income is, so I'll back up. Has the states have the authority to tax their residents and all income earned in their borders. And so for a retiree, they're able to tax them because they're a resident.
Representative Groh.
We know is the tax.
In the mic, please.
I'm sorry. The Tax Foundation says that 43 states in the District of Columbia tax income. So in terms of, I'm not denying there are obviously other states. There are some states famously don't have income taxes, but the vast majority in the United States do.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you. Through the chair, this case law, I'm pretty sure for military, as long as you never become a resident in there, even if you're earning money in the state, they can't tax you in your retirement. I think it's a California law. Has to do with USERRA and a bunch of other stuff, but just I don't know if that's worth that answer to your question or not. So military guy came to Alaska and did not become a resident, and he doesn't have to. Even though he earned money in Alaska, we would not be able to tax him on that in his retirement.
Make comments on that.
Representative Allard.
Okay. Right. I know. And yeah, I mean, what if you want to be a registered voter? I mean, are you saying that? I guess that's something to dig into. Thank you, though, we'll figure it out. Thank you.
And I would just like to say that we're having a hypothetical conversation on a potential tax of some sort. We're having a conversation on an income tax and a sales tax, and we just picked a couple numbers to philosophically have a question about, right? There's no actual proposal before us, no bill, nothing that we can use for concrete analysis. We're just kind of getting some information here as we look for what a bill might look like. Okay, please continue.
And for the record, Colin Glover, just a couple other points. Yeah, the 1% is a low rate. It was just something just to put out there. So, you know, I think if you want to, can't really compare the sales tax versus income tax and the numbers we're presenting. It was just an idea. Like 2% is about double, you know, just something just to give you a sense of magnitude of what it could be. The other comment is, you know, South Dakota and Wyoming are both states that do not have a personal income tax or a corporate income tax. So they are kind of similar to us. And really the sales tax is their biggest revenue generator. But we can look into the model. You know, the model might have some provision for retiree income as well. Like, you know, I know how to use the model. I didn't build it, but we can check into the question about retirees and whether that's already built into our income tax model.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you. And through the chair. So the model just is brute numbers. It doesn't do any kind of economic analysis or economist analysis on how many people would leave the state if we implemented a tax. It's just strictly straight numbers.
Rep. McCabe through the chair. Right. It's calculating the tax, direct tax income only, not an economic impact of that tax policy.
I appreciate you pointing out that a 2% income tax might be a double of 264, but that would be assuming the population wants to live under a 2% income tax, and maybe it isn't exactly double because of that decision. So appreciate that. Please continue.
Thank you. So I appreciate the discussion and questions, but I see that there are touching buttons, which is why I said I didn't want to be the face of this. They're going to be like that. Brandon Spanos wants an income tax and we don't like him. So I'm here to present at the will
the committee legislature. Will provide cover.
Sure, thank you. But should there be a bill, certainly we'll come back and talk about it, and if it were to pass, we'll implement it and administer it as well. Moving on, those were our two options for an income tax. Now we're going to look at expanding the current corporate income tax to include those pass-through companies or pass-through entities that I talked about earlier. So again, most states that have a corporate income tax would also have an income tax, and therefore it captures all income earned in their borders. In Alaska, because our C corporation tax mimics that in other states, like I mentioned, we adopted the multi-state tax compact. It only applies to C corporations, which wouldn't pay a tax under an income tax. So if the legislature wanted to look at pursuing those pass-through entities, you wouldn't want to do this in combination with an income tax because it would be double taxation. You'd be taxing the same income twice. But you could do this instead of an income tax. And this would basically, this scenario is looking only at oil and gas companies. So it's expanding the C-Corp model to oil and gas companies. So those are the companies that fall under 4355, which are basically production or transportation companies. So if that were to be done, the model shows $131 million in FY24. And that is using the current rate structure that we showed earlier in our last presentation of 0 to 9.4% based on what income bracket you fall into. And then the last point there, because we already have all of this built and we already have employees that apply this, there would be no additional cost for this this tax.
So the last one we have is a change to our current oil and gas production tax. This is the sliding scale credit talked about previously as one of our tax exemptions, and that was the one that had the most impact on the state, which for fiscal year 2021 was $740 million. This option just looks at reducing it. I talked about how it's a sliding scale from $8 a barrel to zero. This option cuts off the top kind of brackets and just starts with the $5, and it would be a $5 per barrel credit up until when oil price value is $110 a barrel. So this kind of condenses the scale and it reduces not the impact on today. So in our current spring forecast information, the impact would be $383 million. Increased revenue for fiscal year 24. It does reduce over time. If you've paid attention to any of our spring forecast meetings we've had today, the forecast, oil price forecast is going down in the future. So as oil prices go down, that really impacts the oil and gas production tax. So this change would have a lower revenue impact in the out years because of the decrease in oil prices.
Okay, maybe
Representative McKay, you have a question.
Okay, I guess maybe I'm the slow guy at the table, but okay, so we're reducing the tax credit and we, okay, it's backwards. You reduce a credit, you get more revenue. Okay, now I'm with you guys. Sorry. About 10-second delay there. I was like, how do you reduce? Okay.
We've been talking about taxes for a long time.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. So our last slide is just to kind of put a plug for some other tools that we have. It's a fiscal plan model that came out in a couple years ago. We do update it after every forecast, and it's a really good interactive tool if you want to look at for full fiscal model. It's not just taxes, but it has the budget information loaded. It has different assumptions for oil price. It will have our fall forecast for oil prices, other prices you can put in. It does have an area if you wanted to take one of our scenarios and plug in the increased revenue, you could do that in the model to see the impact. It also has information on the dividend splits and how that impacts the revenue stream to the state. And it has information on the constitutional budget reserve balance as well. So it's a very comprehensive tool that's available on the public. I encourage everybody to look at it, and it's great. It's got this nice summary table that looks just like the summary table that is in the governor's 10-year plan. Base case should look exactly like the governor's plan, so it's just a very good, interactive, user-friendly tool that anybody can use. It's on our public website. So
thank you for bringing that up and informing us about that, and I would encourage the public to check that out.
Mm-hmm. And so the current version is the fall forecast, and we plan to have the spring model done in a couple of weeks.
Very good. Representative Groh.
Thank you very much, Chair Groh. And thank you very much to each of you for this presentation this evening. I wanted to ask about something that...
Closer to the mic, sir.
Sorry. I wanted to ask about something else you did not model, but has been proposed as a bill here recently in the legislature. And it relates to the oil and gas property tax, which you did discuss earlier. There was a bill put in that would have... increased the mill rate from 20 mills to 30 mills, so from 2% to 3%, and then also reserve all of the revenue gain from going from 20 mills to 30 mills to the state, as opposed to the current system, but leaving the first 20 mills to be shared by municipalities if they so chose in terms of their own tax rates. I recall that raise in the order of $200 million was the estimate for the state, and it was a fairly stable source of revenue. Is that accurate?
So, Rep. Groh, through the chair, if I remember right, but just rough math, typically the total amount of the oil and gas property tax is about $550 million. So, a 50% increase would be in the $250 to $275 million range.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Groh. I'm looking for other questions. I think we're pretty close to the end here.
Thank you.
Representative Gray, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I thank you for this. This was really helpful. The comment I was going to make, I was sharing with Representative Allard. I just, for my own comparison, looked up California's tax rates, and they have a 7.25% state sales tax, and their state income tax goes up to 12.3%. And so I was kind of just looking at your numbers and thinking, well, what if we multiplied that times 12.3? You know, it really does. So I appreciate the fact that you used South Dakota and Wyoming, that you used sort of the much more conservative models to just show, like, if a very small tax was imposed, you would get this much value or this much revenue brought in. So I appreciated that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Any other questions? Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So yeah, I have a, so this is sort of a high level question, but for instance, 1% personal income tax, you have 1% for adjusted gross income base and then 1% federal tax liability base. Which one would you call, say, a flat tax?
It's like we're looking on slide six.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. Six.
So through the chair, Representative McCabe, the flat tax would be the adjusted gross income option because the on slide seven, the federal tax brackets have already been applied to the federal tax liability.
So through follow up.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So through the chair. So just so it's clear for other folks, I mean, I worked in this in the fiscal policy working group. So the federal tax liability base would already encompass the what we call the progressive tax, or the, you know, the higher your wage, the higher tax you pay. So that would be encompassed on there. It's actually sort of surprising to me that the flat tax actually seems to earn a little bit more.
So
just to finish up my snarky comment, I thought that we had a bunch of millionaires in Alaska, maybe even billionaire dentists, that would be able to, with a progressive tax, make us a pile of money.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, it is apples and oranges that we're comparing. So the adjusted gross income, AGI, is a much larger number than the federal tax liability, which is the tax paid on the AGI. So it's a much smaller number.
Follow up.
Representative McCabe.
So just looking at these two charts, and a flat tax would be because it's spread out. It's really broad over, if you think of it broad, meaning over the entire population. So if you earn $10 or if you earn $10 million, you're paying 1%. So everybody's involved. I think a lot of the fair tax, flat tax folks are, that's what they bank on. And this kind of shows that we actually earn more income from tax if we spread it out over the entire cross-section of the population, instead of depending on sort of the rich 5% or whatever to handle our tax increase. Does that make sense?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, it does make sense. There's certainly different schools of thought on that. The AGI at 1% could be modeled AGI with brackets. We didn't do that here, but it would give a different number.
Right.
So.
Thank you.
Representative McKay.
We have time, Chairman Carpenter.
I think we will.
Okay.
While the time.
Okay, this is very informative. Thank you. And through the chair, I think it would be helpful for our committee to make sure everybody knows, for example, C-Corps and S-Corps in Alaska, oil and gas, ConocoPhillips, C-Corp, correct?
Through the chair, Representative McKay, we can answer that because it's public information that they're right. The C-Corp. Yes.
Yeah, and then Hillcorp is an S-Corp.
Through the chair, Representative McKay, that's not public information. We can't speak
okay.
to that.
I guess everybody knows that anyway. All right. All right, that's an interesting.
Representative McKay.
Okay, and then you might want, can you define legacy fields? Because maybe not everybody in the committee knows exactly what they are. On the slope, Prudhoe Bay, Kaparik, Alpine.
Correct, Rep. McKay. It's anything that had been in existence prior to when there was the legislation to give kind of the gross reduction, gross value reduction. But yeah, primarily Prudhoe, Kaparik, Alpine, and the ones that have been in place for a while.
Okay, I just want to make sure our committee knew that basic information because it could be very important. If I could do a follow-up.
Representative McKay.
Okay, so when the state passed ACEs, I think it was 2003, somewhere in that neighborhood, a significant increase in oil taxes was imposed, and there was a corresponding drop in activity on the slope and production. Can somebody show us that information at some point in time?
Rep. McKay, we can provide some historical information on that.
I think it would be very interesting to see that over the many years that we've been producing. And how that type of behavior by the state does affect production on the slope. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Representative McKay, for the questions. Okay. Does this bring us to the, looks like you have something else to add.
If I could just add, I mentioned earlier, should the legislature choose to pass an income tax, we would administer it. I should note back to our disclaimer, of course, I do not speak for the governor, and he has veto authority. So if the legislature and the governor chose to implement that, we would administer it.
Thank you. Okay. We're at about 20 minutes left, and I think we're going to hold over the introduction of HB 109 until our next meeting in the interest of time this evening, because I think we're going to need more time than that. So if there are no other questions and you folks do not have any other anything to add, I think we will call this meeting adjourned as of 7:41 p.m.